This is Rabbi G, and welcome to Harvard God and Gen Z. The goal of this podcast is to discuss life's big questions with some of America's brightest young minds. We will discuss Harvard's continued sway on the imagination as the peak of success. We will discuss how to get there and what it is like when you do. We will then shift to discuss if and in what ways meaning and God are relevant features of Gen Z. What better place than Harvard for discussing these issues with the thought leaders of tomorrow? Welcome back, everybody. We are thrilled today to have one of the most amazing people I have met during my time at Harvard. Definitely one of the most intellectual minds at Harvard. One of the most worldly minds I've met at Harvard. Someone who inspires me in great ways with how much he cares about many different issues around the world. Cengiz graduated Harvard 2018, originally from Istanbul. And it's a pleasure to pick his mind. And really, this might be the first interview where we may agree to disagree, which I'm also excited about. So let's get into it. So Cengiz, welcome. Thank you so much for joining.
Hi, Rabbi. Thank you so much for having me.
So tell me, so what have you been doing since 2018? Where are you located? What are you working on?
Yeah, so when I graduated from Harvard, I decided to pack up my stuff and move to Copenhagen, Denmark, to work at a management consultancy called Red Associates, a Scandinavian consultancy that has offices in New York and London and Paris and Copenhagen. And we help Fortune 500 companies, governments, and NGOs come up with strategies for the future. But we have a more anthropological angle to it. If you think that, you know, modern management science is based on Cartesian logic, like Descartes' I think, therefore I am kind of logic, then we base it on more of an existentialism Heideggerian logic. So we believe that people in the world are first and foremost experiencing beings rather than thinking beings. Yeah, which was, I think, a philosophy that I myself aligned pretty closely with and figured it would be a fascinating experience to join Red Associates.
And what's the outcome difference of people more experiential as opposed to...
Yeah, the outcome difference, Rabbi, is that when we think that people are thinking beings, we believe that when we ask them what they think of XYZ, they're actually telling us the truth, or they're telling us what they actually think. But when we believe that people are first and foremost experiencing beings, we're actually implicitly claiming that people don't have all the capabilities to analyze and communicate what they actually experience and think. And ultimately, their experience, we experience one thing, but then we put it into words in a different way than what we experience, because our language limits the totality of what we can experience. Hence, we say, you know, when you use big data, or when you use artificial intelligence, or when you use these types of like quantitative surveys or 21st century quantified social science methods, ultimately you are ending with data that is not deep enough, that is not thick enough, that doesn't get at the back end of why people do what they do or why people think what they think.
Doesn't that data reflect what their actions are, what they end up doing regardless of their thoughts? Or
for sure it does. But without understanding the thought patterns and why, like the causations behind the existing behaviors, which can only be attained in today's world through interpretive leaps, through kind of more interpretive sciences, right? Like that's what anthropology does. That's what arts and humanities do. That's what philosophy does, where we say, well, think of concepts like religion or jealousy or faith or destiny or any other concept that is deeply important for humanity, but we cannot quantify or we cannot exactly express how that impacts our lives. Nobody knows. I mean, we know implicitly, but we don't have the mental faculties / linguistic capabilities to put it into exact words. Hence, most of the modern management science has been ignoring these concepts. It's been saying that, you know what, faith actually doesn't matter because I can't put a reliable number on it. Hence, I will not use it in my decision-making process when I chart the future. What we're saying is the totality of the human experience matters. Hence, we need to introduce all aspects of it, quantifiable and unquantifiable, purely qualifiable aspects, before we as businesses or as policymakers or as, you know, NGO folks, make decisions about our products, our sales strategies, mm-hmm. who we hire, where we sell, all of that.
Makes sense to me. And I could spend probably another 3 hours just discussing this topic with you. So tell us a little bit. So this is what you're doing now. How did you get here? So you grew up in Turkey, I understand, Istanbul. How many people from Istanbul end up at Harvard? How did you even know about Harvard? How did you get there?
Great question, Rabbi. I mean, I did not really know about Harvard, to be frank. My family is coming from Baku, Azerbaijan. They are from a small community called Mountain Juice, which is outside of, it's in the kind of northern, they come from northern side of Azerbaijan. And after Soviet Union collapsed, they kind of packed their bags and first moved to Israel. And after a very, very brief stint in Israel, moved to Turkey, into Istanbul, where my mom and dad kind of settled and where I grew up. So I consider Istanbul in many ways to be kind of the city that formed me and where I became who I am today, and infused with, I think, a combination of both Jewish values and Turkish values and Azeri values and Soviet values.
Major differences between them or any very conflicting values or just slightly different realms?
I think so. I mean, it's all Middle Eastern cultures, right? Like in a way, there's a lot that they share together, but there's also, one could claim, like ontological or how to say it, historicized differences in terms of what is a good life one should lead. And I think, or what is a type of mental model one should have towards the world? Like, for example, one value that I think Turkish society has that Jews also have, that we share actually, is adaptability. Mm-hmm. I think Turks will always say that, you know, whatever conditions I will find myself in, and you can find it in Turkish diaspora, right? Like the kebab store owners in Germany or whatever entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley or whoever else, like somebody who moves to Dubai and is trying to do something there. Regardless of the context, I can make this home for myself. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, for example, a value that both Judaism and Turkishness shares. And I think has been deeply infused in me. You know, I moved on from Turkey when I was 16 to Hong Kong to do my high school. And then I won this scholarship that Turkish government was giving. So, and actually they chose me as a minority student, right? I was a minority in Turkey. And so they sent me to Hong Kong to represent Turkey in a way. And which to me also—
So they sent both Turkish students and Turkish minority students together?
So Turkish students, Turkish minority students, so it didn't matter. And they actually preferred some once in a while Turkish minority students to also kind of signal to the world that, you know, Turkey has non-Turkish people living in there. And two, that you as a minority person who grew up in Turkey are equally equipped to represent Turkey or kind of share Turkish values or Turkish opinion with the world as much as a kind of a fully Turkish person is.
Did you feel like a minority growing up in Turkey or it didn't come up so much?
Not really. That's the thing. I think my family, we moved into a part of Istanbul called Immigrant Town, which is it's really called that. It's like a series of public housing buildings that are built by the government to house at the time a lot of people who immigrated, let's say Chechnya wars or Bulgaria wars or Balkan wars, from kind of Iraq violence, all types of stuff. So people of all religions and whoever kind of needed a safe refuge. At the time, Turkey had an extremely liberal migration policy where, you know, it was impossible to move to most of the places and Turkey had open borders. You would just show up at the border and say, I need asylum, I need a home, and they will allow you in, which I think is another thing that really framed my worldview later on in terms of how much opportunity Turkey gave for people whose lives went astray without their control, right? When war happens or drought happens or flood happens or conflict happens, like often these people, or me, myself included, they have no agency to change it or to do anything about it. And it's not their fault. And life can go astray so quickly, all of a sudden. And because of the kind of modern 21st century immigration laws and the way in which we created these selfish national states that are self-interested and realpolitik and blah, 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 too often we leave people to their own destiny. And to me, I guess, more liberal immigration policies, what they showed at an early age is that it's actually giving a second chance.
And you found it worked. In other words, the population was able to get along together plus integrate into society. sufficient.
For sure. I think we all, and that's why, like, today, right? Like, when people ask me, I gladly say I'm from Istanbul, I'm Turkish. And then sometimes as a nuance, I'll add that I'm from the Jewish minority or from the Jewish community and da da da. But to me, I guess there was so much generosity and so much kindness and so much opportunity that the institutions there and the people there and the society there provided. It's a home. And in a way, I see that as a, yeah, in a way, like when a society welcomes people who they didn't have to welcome, right? I think it's then, I see it at least a partial responsibility of myself to then say, you know, they have spent X amount of resources or generosity and whatever on me. And now it's on me to say that, to acknowledge that, to celebrate that, and to spread that. Sure. And to also advocate to say, look, there's so much benefits in allowing a second chance for people whose lives went astray. Mm-hmm. And we as a globe should be building institutions and frameworks and policies to actually allow more liberal immigration policies, more flexibility and more understanding across the borders. Because you know what? Like today's rich countries, or let me put it this way, today's poor countries were rich one day, and today's very rich countries mm-hmm. can end up poor one day.
Sure.
You know, we live in a world in which nothing is predictable and we do not know. It looks so certain.
It's funny. Talmud says there's something very similar about you should give because you don't know if your next generation is going to be the one that needs. We don't know. 100%.
We don't know.
Can't agree with you more.
No, I agree with that.
But do you think the Turkish is positioned in a unique place? In other words, because of the cultural melting pot of kind of being between Europe and Asia, that has the diversity to be able to. Or do you think any country really could accomplish the same thing?
I think any country could accomplish it if they put their hearts and souls into it. And if there is if you can get enough people in a country to understand that if more people who are not like them lived in that place, they and the others would be better off, then more countries can be made that way. And today, I think we're seeing that in a variety of places, like statistics. And often I read these statistics that say, you know, people who live close to people who are not like them actually find it to be a very fulfilling experience. And they understand mm-hmm. that the other provides so much less threat than they thought about it.
Sure.
And the people who often do not want others are the ones who've never met the others or never live around the others. So it's just like you kind of try to keep away from the ones you're scared of. And only through exposure, you stop being scared of them. I think, you know, American politics shows this, British politics shows this.
Sure, rural urban divide, I think that's what it is. And did you work hard and aspire to accomplish, do you think you had a bit of an immigrant mentality and because your parents kind of were uprooted, you had to be the one to carry, you know, an opportunity now, a new opportunity, you could bridge it forward, do you think, or naturally just intellectually curious? So.
I think my family had a couple core values that, of course, I think catapulted me, but they were definitely not like tiger mom model at all, like the opposite of that, in fact. I think my parents really valued, I think one core tenet they have that I still hold very near to my heart is that one can learn something from every single human and every single experience in this world. So nobody is below you or nobody is above you, and no experience is a waste of time. So even the most boring lecture or the most like undesirable looking athletic contest or whatever, right? Like yep, if you I'm feel that you. Naturally you have no interest in something, actually one should lean into that thing that you think you have no interest in.
Yep.
Because that leaning is actually going to grow you more than something that naturally feels more interesting to you. And I think I kind of structured my life around that. I tried to make choices and friendships and kind of associations and always to expose myself to like very divergent ways of thinking. Mm-hmm. And you know that, you know, kind of in a way I approached my Harvard experience in a very similar way. I tried to curate my extracurriculars, my classes, my friends and my experiences to be as oppositional and as like stretching me to places that I'm not very comfortable or not necessarily very well versed in or feel that I'm a part of this. Because I think those things then stretch, first of all, they stretch my identity of where, like, make me more me and like, because we're all malleable individuals, right? So these types of experiences that actually ultimately form us and makes us explore who we really are at the core. And secondly, it grows us through purely understanding the diversity of experiences and the diversity of approaches and angles and gazes that mm-hmm. this whole, the world and the universe has. Hence, I think there's so much value in, I mean, it's not me, once again, sorry, diluting the topic, but going back to what my parents, you know, kind of infused in me from an earlier age, is that all the way from physics to literature, there's something to gain out of. And one should not say, you know, this is an irrelevant discipline or this is an irrelevant person or a way of looking, even things that are unfounded, right? Like even lies, one can learn something from. So so that I think is a core belief that really, I feel at least when I look back into my past life, has catapulted me in a certain way, because it always pushed me to try to aspire to be in places and associated with people who are going to then provide those experiences. And as I kind of grew up, then for me, that kind of adventure, United World College, that international high school I went to, was the first step of that. And then when I was there, I realized there is an opportunity to apply to American liberal arts schools, and that they have very generous financial aid offerings, because my family could not afford it, for international students. I actually was not very attracted to the United States as a person, I think, for reasons beyond my understanding. So I wanted to, you know, study in Europe and da, da, da. And then, like, after research, I realized, honestly, the United States has the best support for people who need support. So, yeah, and that's changed kind of my trajectory. And once I understood what liberal arts meant as a kind of an educational philosophy, I figured it's actually much more in line with the type of education and upbringing I'd like to have, right, more so than a kind of one single discipline and go deep into that. And that's why United States and education in United States came to the forefront. And and I just kind of took a chance, Rabbi, by applying to Harvard. It was not even in my, like, in my high school, we were only allowed to apply to 10 universities. And I remember the 10th one I had was Swarthmore College, you know, this little liberal arts school outside of Philadelphia. I was mostly choosing schools that are, like, very liberal leaning, because I was like, you know, I'm a pretty liberal person and would like to be surrounded by, you know, more open-minded kind of environment and da da da. And then a friend of mine, I remember, a very close Indonesian friend of mine in high school, came up to me one day and was like, "Chingiz, are you applying to Harvard?" And I was like, "No." And she said, "Why?" And I said, "I don't, you know, like, I'm not that kind of person. Like, I..."
That kind of person, meaning that's in the box, or?
No, exactly. In my mind, I was like, I'm a good student, but I'm not that good of a student. And, like, you know, or, and in my mind, I guess the people who went to Harvard were, you know, global champion of something, or, you know, like, won some really large global competition or Olympic athlete and da da da. And I felt that I was not at that level. And she said, "You know what? You never know. You do pretty cool things and you have a very unique story and you have a lot of drive, and just try it." And I said, and she said, I remember with this, because she said, "You know what? You're only 18 once in your life. And if you don't apply now, you will never know whether you would have gotten in. You would have only just believed that you would never get in." And I was like, "You know what? She's kind of right." Because I created this idea that I would not get in, hence I'm not applying. So I might as well just try it. And if I don't get in, then I was right. And if I get in, then I was wrong. And that's how I did it. I kind of just switched Swarthmore with Harvard. And then I ended up applying to it.
It's amazing the serendipitous encounters we have with people that can radically change the course of our lives.
No, exactly. I wonder, you know, sometimes, like, people will say it was meant to be and da, 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 and I wonder whether it was meant to be or it was just like pure accident. I don't know. But long story short, that's how I ended up.
That's how you did it. And did it live up to its intellectual promise? I mentioned you were one of the more intellectual people I've met. Did you find that also, that it wasn't quite as intellectually minded and more professional minded, or you found enough people out there that were?
I think it's definitely surprised me, because it felt so much more practical, meaning I felt that when I arrived to Harvard, everybody was just looking for after Harvard. Like, from day one, it felt like everyone was just looking for the next thing after Harvard, what they would do. And so much less focus on kind of our intellectual growth and personality growth and everything within this 4-year kind of contained period. But there were definitely pockets of that. And I think, you know, my engagement with you through Mayor was for me a pocket of that. I volunteered in this kind of race relations diversity office called Harvard Foundation. For me, that was a pocket of that. Some other extracurriculars that I joined, or some academic choices I made, like I chose to study anthropology because I thought people who study anthropology, which actually turned out to be pretty true, they're much more focused on kind of exploring the world right now rather than thinking about, you know, what is the next job and the next job and the next job that I'm going to get. So I found pockets of that, I think, intellectualism at Harvard, and try to kind of lean into those pockets. But I also often, Rabbi, found some intellectual pockets that were deeply arrogant. Mm-hmm. So to me, it was important to kind of find that balance of like vulnerable intelligence, maybe, I think is a nice way to put it. Like what types of communities I can be a part of where people are willing to be vulnerable and open themselves up and share like what they know, but also admit what they don't know. And you kind of learn through that process of what you know and what you don't know through that kind of a souping of it. While I also found too many, I think, little pockets where it was this like very high worded intellectualism infused with a lot of arrogance and privilege and just lack of admittance that you might not know something and performativity. But overall, I think, you know, with all of its shortcomings, I think Harvard is still one of the best things that ever happened in my life. I learned, I met some lifelong friends, really grew as a person and understood, because I think, Rabbi, Harvard is actually really good at teaching how life works. This is my conviction.
In what way?
Because it's not an intellectual, it's not like this like intellectual kind of capsule where you're just discussing intellectual things, but everything is often linked and applied to life's own dynamics in terms of profits, like how capitalism works, how networking works, how the Western world is as corrupt as the Eastern world.
So you find yourself, you found Harvard to be, you found enough intellectual.
Yes.
You also found that it also prepared you for life in a certain way, had certain practical aspects. So let's shift gears a little bit. So you grew up, as you mentioned, your parents had a Soviet background. So it's interesting. You tell me about the values your mother imbued, and I'm just singing in my head thinking, wow, those are such Jewish values. You know, we have a famous Mishnah called, who is the wise person? He who learns from everybody. We have a whole concept of what's called Hitlamdu, which is learning from the world. So everything you tell me is very Jewish, but obviously it wasn't necessarily overtly Jewish. It was more cultural.
It's just like kind of factually posed as this is how one should approach life. And I think I was always aware that they're infused with Judaic upbringing and Judaic culture, but it was not explicitly put as this is a Jewish value.
And did the concept of spirituality ever come up growing up? Was that a topic discussed or
part of your life
in any way?
I think it was often positioned as, and this is, I guess, my conviction more or less today as well, that there are certain things in the world that we cannot explain, that we as humans, our science, our brain, our experience, right? Like kind of going back to that Cartesian logic thing, there's kind of suprahuman experiences that exist in the world. And we don't have the capabilities to explain it. We've been aware of it for a very, very long time as humanity. Hence, we should believe in some form of the existence of something out there that we cannot explain. Maybe we'll be able to explain it one day. Maybe we won't be able to explain it one day. But we should not ignore that something exists that we cannot explore. So that's why I think my upbringing was never atheistic, because it felt both to me and I think to my parents relatively dogmatic to say, I know there's nothing. And kind of haughty in a way, like arrogant to be like, you know, there's nothing. So that was never there, I think. But it was also never explicitly religious outside of its communal aspect. So I think one of the, and I still feel that, like I was just telling you that I joined this Reform synagogue here in Copenhagen. And actually the first time I went there for Rosh Hashanah services, I got really emotional. Like I was kind of like tearing up and felt emotional and moved by the words that were on, and they were not necessarily, that's the thing, they were like more value-based kind of prayers rather than, you know, Jacob did this or da-da-da or like anything like that, right?
Well, can you give me an example of a value-based prayer?
So it was like, I commit to stand by the ones who have less than me. You know, a phrase like that. It just made me think, even like saying that out loud, I think made me be aware that maybe I didn't do that as much as I would have liked. Maybe it was in my idealized version of myself, I do that all the time. But when I kind of sense checked with myself one-on-one, when in that moment of prayer, right, like of that recital, then I was like, oh no, Chinggis, you actually don't do this as much as you should do.
When you say you should do, that sounds kind of like there's some objective standard you're holding yourself to. Where does that come from, this internal drive that you seem to imply that there are certain values you should be doing, which, you know, basically you just expressed you should be giving more? Is that innate? Is that something, because technically speaking, if we were to take maybe a evolutionary view of things, okay, you could believe in evolutionary altruism, but even then it would still be a matter of taste or, you know, something we evolved to do, but do I have to do it? Where would the have to come in?
Yeah, I guess it's a little bit like when I look at the influence, I think it's a little bit of logical deduction. It's a little bit It's a little bit of logical deduction. It's a little bit of educational upbringing. It's a little bit of just a feeling that I cannot explain.
Okay.
So I think the combination of all three. When I say educational upbringing, it's kind of, I think, the modern 21st century, you know, UN Declaration of Human Rights. And
where do you think that comes from? Is that just humans agreed, came together? You think it's rooted in something else?
My take would be, once again, there's an explainable part and there's a less explainable part. The more explainable part is that we as humans, over the course of thousands of years of society building, have figured out ways in which we can best build societies mm-hmm. that are sustainable, that maximize the satisfaction and joy of life for everybody involved. And I think, you know, this, we are at the cutting edge of it right now with the social justice movements and equality, even like kind of bringing equality to the next levels. And John Rawls, which is a wonderful philosopher that I would recommend everyone to read, you know, he has Bale of Ignorance and that type of, I think, ideas, right? Structured a lot of modern thinking about that and structured my own thinking about it. I think logical deduction when I say, so that was the first, right? Educational logical deduction. And that for me was around just me and thinking by myself, right? Like when I live in the world, if I were to act a certain way, and if everybody around me, like kind of Kant's imperative, categorical imperative, if everyone around me was to act in a certain way, would we live in a better world or a worse world? I think is a way in which I think. And then there's the more unexplainable element. I mean, it's explainable perhaps through biology somehow, where you could say, you know, like there's also satisfaction, like personal selfish satisfaction in doing good in the world, where you feel better about yourself and about your existence. You feel that you have a point of existence. And
yeah, can you explain that to me? So what makes that meaningful to do that outside? Again, it's a nice thing to do and it makes us feel good. But is it just a sophisticated type of hedonism? Or
no,
is it actually more than that?
Yes. I think it's pretty linked with agency in my eyes, is that we as humans are one of the very few species that we're aware of, I guess, that have near full, I mean, of course, all these definitions are based on us as like biased processors of information. Near full agency of our own lives and the globe, right? Mm-hmm. Meaning we, our acts, our words, our thoughts impact everybody else around us. Meaning we have a big responsibility, each one of us, because we touch lives and things beyond just us in a very structural way. Hence, I think that's why we feel, at least that's my reasoning of why I might feel that I have a mandate in this world, or like I have a responsibility in this world, or a way of living in this world that could impact, that should generate positive impacts, that should drive that when I'm like gone from this world, that I have, this is a model that I actually think on a day-to-day basis. Let's say in a given 24 hours, have I consumed more or have I produced more? Mm-hmm. And I think it's actually an important balance that most of us don't think. Like even like think about every time you listen to a podcast, every time you listen to a song, you watch a movie, you read news, you do whatever, right? We're actually consuming. Like it's not only like shirts we're consuming, you know? We also consume all form of information. But how much information do we put out there? How much like art do we create? Or how much new ideas we generate? Or how much goodness we spread? We consume a lot of goodness actually on a daily basis. So I guess one of my lifelong missions is to be like a net producer rather than a net consumer.
Sure.
At the end of my life. Hopefully I'll reach there. but yeah.
So you said a lot of things. I'd like to maybe just break them down. So again, I hate to keep repeating myself, but you know, each thing you said is again, I could show you the quote and the source for it, you know. For me, the world was created, meaning not in a selfish way, but all the problems in the world are relevant to me and I have an agency in them. But this powerful message that you're describing of agency and that we affect everything. So many people I find nowadays, you know, with kind of the increase in mental health issues are feeling so powerless, don't feel that life matters at all. don't feel like they impact anything, they feel like overwhelmed. Where are you getting that energy and that strength to say, no, I do matter. I understand I'm important. I understand that everything I do impacts. Because I find many people have trouble seeing that.
You're right, Rabbi. You're right, because I also see many people who have trouble seeing that. I think it's because a part of it that I'm able to observe is around the notion that little impact is no impact. Like thinking as if, you know, little acts of kindness don't matter because structure is wrong. So there's a whole subgenre of person, right, who then starts blaming capitalism for everything and starts blaming politicians for everything and starts blaming like the injustice for everything. Well, of course there are structures and they impose the kind of architecture under which we need to live. But we as humans have agency to also change those roofs. Like all of these are created by us in many ways, right? Injustice is also created by us, and poverty is also created by us. And yeah, regardless, you got it. But I guess the reason I'm able to see a sense of agency in myself and in others is because I know, or my mental model is as such, that every structure is malleable by human force. And every structure is actually a collection of behavioral habits. If each one of us were to act in a certain way, we could break certain structures. So it doesn't mean that I should not act a certain way just because if others are not acting that way, structures won't change. Because I think my act in itself has symbolic meaning. This is actually a concept that I believe, now I'm going to assign it to a structure, but kind of, you know, economicized thinking, like rational, quantified thinking has eroded in our lives. And actually religion to an extent holds it. It's about the symbolism of our acts and symbolism of our thoughts. Like every individual and everything they do and everything they say can be symbolic of something. And symbolic value, I would say, is sometimes as important, if not more important, than inherent value in the word of our words or in our acts and all of that. So,
can you give an example of that?
Yeah, like if I were to, I'll give an American example, right? Like, for example, there was that football player who kneeled during national anthem. Mm-hmm. The act of kneeling in national anthem does not matter. The symbolism of it matters. That's a pretty like kind of foundational core example. Or let's say, when I say hi to my neighbor next door, when I go to work in the morning, mm-hmm. my word hi in itself does not, one can think, does not change this neighbor's life. I mean, it might, but one might think it's too minor and like doesn't matter and da da da. But symbolically what it tells my neighbor is that I am interested in engaging with her, mm-hmm. that I am acknowledging her existence and presence.
And it creates a warmer world for her in general, that exactly. All the world she lives
so
in.
Is different. Kind of, yeah, exactly. So those downstream consequences of these little acts can mean so much and can collect up to be so much. So that's why I think that sense of agency is very, very important. And when humanity loses its sense of agency, like what are we? We're like trees then.
I'm with you. And I speak to a lot of students about this. They're kind of waiting to make millions of dollars to make big impacts. And I always tell them, you don't know how far a smile can go in a person's life on a day-to-day basis, these small acts. And I think you explained it beautifully. They're not small. They can be rooted in these big symbolisms that are very positive. You also said another thing that I found fascinating, that you're trying to leave the world a more positive, net positive, that you gave to the world more than you took in a way. So again, I think we're living a little bit in a nihilistic world. You know, why should it matter? Why do you care that you live in a positive place? Why can't you just enjoy your life? And
because, yeah, Rabbi, because the life that I'm living right now is enabled by all the sacrifices and all the givings of the people before me.
Okay.
And I think it is our duty. In a way, like I see kind of human existence on the planet as this like puzzle we're trying to resolve. We're trying to, as humanity, find the most perfect way of coexisting and living and being happy and in kind of getting rid of all our problems. We've made great progress in that mission. And also understanding like foundational questions of existence, like why do we exist? We still don't know. What's gonna happen after we die? We still don't know. Like there's all these like questions we don't know. And in a way, we've made a lot of strides in answering a lot of them, and we still have a ton of unknowns. So to me, it's my contributions that are part of that human journey. You know, it's not a part of my journey in a way. I mean, I'm just like a little dot in that humanity's journey. I just feel that we as humans should have or feel a sense of duty and responsibility to contribute to our collective journey.
It sounds like that sense of duty that you're discussing is really bubbles up, I think, from a more fundamental aspect. You can correct me if I'm wrong. Really, what I heard from your words is a sense of gratitude. That you feel a sense of gratitude to those who enabled you to live your life. And there, that gratitude is what really pushes your sense of duty. Would that be accurate?
I think that's definitely a solid, 50% of it. And then the other, for sure, I think that's a very big part of it. And I think the other big part of it is this kind of curiosity angle. Sure. That there is so much to answer in the world and so much to still know that we should not just sit behind and, do nothing and consume.
Couldn't agree more. And do you believe that the religious concept of kind of the dignity of every human being rooted in that concept of, everyone created in the divine image is important to this worldview that you're proposing?
My honest answer is not really. I think a part of what you're saying that is important for this image is that human life is valuable, that human life is important, that life is valuable and life is important. So I think that of course has that idea that we developed as humanity has deep religious roots. And so in that aspect, what you're saying, I would agree with and has place in my own kind of life approach of philosophy and spirituality. That life is this fascinating, unexplainable thing, occurrence, that should not be taken away or wasted or put to wrong use. I guess that's the way in which I would reframe what you're suggesting.
I understand. So you mentioned a few times kind of the unexplainable dimension of life, and I agree with you, obviously. There's always going to be a dimension. One reason they actually we work keep us in the traditional sense is to actually indicate to everybody that I realize there's a limit to my knowledge, that my knowledge is kept, and I'm humbled before the world in a way, before God, obviously, that I can't know everything as a human being. So that's definitely a big part of it. But the idea that, when you do think about the unexplainable, does that, the classic argument on some level that, from nothing, nothing comes, therefore necessitate that there be something. I know you called it an energy, something we don't know, and I agree we might not know much about it, but does it necessitate something to have be behind everything? Is that fair to say?
Yeah, my take on it is that we have lower level questions we need to answer to have the best answer for such a difficult question. Is that my personal read is that, origination myths or either tribal origination myths or structured religious creation ideas are incomplete explanations of how we came to be. I think they might have fragments of truth in them or ideas that have served us really well and should continue to serve us very well. But I think we don't have the full technologies, capabilities, lenses, and kind of interpretive leaps to find the right answer to that question yet. I don't think that's our generation's, sadly, discovery to make. But I think in some future generation, hopefully that will be answered.
And does not having that answer for you produce a sense of any anxiety to that? To not knowing or not knowing what happens after you die? Or does that in any way bother you?
Not really, because I think so many people before me knew less than I do. And so many people after I, hopefully if I make the impact and my generation makes the impact we should be making, will know more than we do. So ultimately one day there will be somebody, and maybe I will be there to hear it or know it, or maybe I won't, but somebody will finally, I think, I hope, will come to some form of realization and explanation of phenomena we don't know about. So to me personally, it doesn't cause that anxiety because I think I'm on a journey, not an individual journey necessarily, but a collective humanity journey to uncover all these questions. And so it, to me, it's like a research question that I'm contributing to. It's just that this research is a millennia long research.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. So I just know no one, people listening can't see my face, but I've been smiling this entire time. Always enjoy hearing Cengiz's thoughts. And, you know, I think when I listen to them, I see, you know, obviously from my perspective, I see so much of it is laden with many of the values that are kind of baked in. But, you know, your desire to change the world positively and your deep drive to search for something more and to leave the world a better place, I don't think that's a given. I think that's a unique thing that you have. But I think it is baked in with values. And I'm still curious whether or not that's sustainable if there's not a value structure such as religion to really promulgate values like the ones that you are mentioning. And otherwise, those values could be there, but they could also not be there. And many people would choose to live very differently than you and choose to leave the world a worse place, enjoy it for themselves while they're here. And I'm curious if that you see any role in at least that dimension to promulgate these values.
The thing is, I think I personally have borrowed a bunch of my values implicitly and explicitly from religious sources. However, I think considering that organized religions around the world have some of the world's most wonderful people in them and some of the world's least wonderful people in them.
Sure.
As much as, you know, people who don't associate with religions have some of the best and some of the worst people in them. So to me, I guess goodness can exist outside of any organized thoughts. And it's in a way beyond all of these organized explanations of phenomena. Yeah.
And goodness you would define basically as empathy and caring and wanting to be positive. That's kind of
good. I think it's like, I guess goodness, I would say, you know, attempting to leave a net positive to the world than net negative. And it's difficult. I think it's one of the most difficult questions to define goodness because it's one of those moral definitions that we don't have an answer for, that we're on a journey to answer. So sadly, I can't provide you a good definition of goodness.
Thank you so much for all your thoughts, and hopefully we continue the conversation because there's still many areas I would still have to explore with you. But
thank you so much, Rabbi.
A real treat, as always, to talk about these ideas.
You always intrigue. Very good. You always inspire a lot of good questions to ponder upon. And I always enjoy our conversations because it opens up new avenues of reflections and questions that I often postpone thinking about or think, you know, I should put in a back burner and one day revisit. And I think you bring them to the forefront that I really appreciate. Thank you a lot, Rabbi.
Thank you so much.